This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 23rd of December 2012 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Weekly is brought to you in association with Tourism Australia.
Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 181, with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
On today's show, we'll be living on the edge and looking into that much maligned part of the city, the suburbs, with the historian Nick Barrett.
We'll also be talking fashion, with many clothing companies employing low-paid workers. We'll ask fair trade fashion pioneers Sophia Minnie and Dean Newcomb if a high street bargain is too high a price to pay.
And with Christmas just around the corner, we'll be discussing a sound often not heard at carol services, Bangra music, with musician Kujit Bamra.
All that to come, plus the triumphant return of Tom Edwards to cast his eye over the week's news, and a tune or two, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. First of all, Andrew, welcome, listeners, to the, I think, the penultimate show of the year, the penultimate Monocle Weekly of the year.
Right. Yes, just a couple of days, obviously, to Christmas.
And a couple of days shy of, of the festivities.
And I'm off tomorrow. I'm away.
Bye.
Getting out of here.
I'm getting out of here. where's Christmas? You're going down to the countryside, right?
Going to the countryside, and it's my birthday tomorrow.
Ah.
You can say happy birthday. Don't just shuffle your papers. Be nice. You're writing me a little
note. Writing it down. I was just signing the card. Yeah. Happy birthday for tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
That calls for a party. Do you know what else happened this week? Do you know what other party happened this week?
We had the Monocle party.
This table's a bit rickety.
I know.
It's feeling a bit like we all are this week. A little bit rickety after there. It's had one too many glasses of glug.
And a very nice party. And it's funny, I always think over the 7 years that we've been having those parties now, that you can kind of mark our progress in placemats. Because every year you need a few more.
Yes, exactly.
And we had 100, well, there was us with Team Wink as well, but there was 130 people, I think, for sit-down dinner.
Which is a big deal. Yeah. And then trying to squeeze them all onto the dance floor at the same time.
Yeah,
Why everyone was dancing so close and grinding up against each other?
There just wasn't room.
Well, I don't know, because there's quite a lot of people in a small space. I mean, it was a big ballroom, but we'd put a table on most of that room.
And right? The other thing I liked is that we brought in some of the correspondents who've done the kind of the most reporting for Monocle 24 over the past year. So Joseph Dana came in from the West Bank.
It's always good at Christmas, someone called Joseph.
Yes.
Welcome.
From the Holy Land.
Yes.
He came. He was here at the party. And Liam Aldous came in from Madrid. And then we also had our Milan correspondent, Ivan Carvalho, here as well.
Ivan Carvalho came bearing gifts, didn't he? So he brought in like a suck up child at classroom. He brought you an apple, didn't he?
He brought a giant box of chocolates for everyone in the office. I think that was
I thought they were just for you.
I thought that was the way to go. I felt that Liam Aldous let himself down a bit by not bringing a present.
Yeah, you've seen what I've got for your birthday though.
I can see it scratched, a little scratchy note on the side of your script. I'm going to get an autographed script for my birthday.
Exactly. That'll
be the best I can hope for.
With best wishes for the season, Rob. There we go. That's all right. And the office takes on a strange thing. When we sort of, we're looking forward to commissioning our March issue right now. We've just finished Feb, but it's still on the wall. It's not in the shops. And the Christmas party happens and everyone's kind of like jumping on planes and trains and going here, there and everywhere. It's a strange but kind of great kind of, it probably does feel like school, that kind of last day of term kind of feeling at school pervades the whole week.
I think especially like last Thursday and Friday, it really felt like everyone was kind of like racing for the final hurdles. Obviously, Monocle 24 is, you know, live and here over the whole of the Christmas period, but the magazine kind of goes very quiet for 10 days. So all those people, and also, you know, we've kind of fixed it so that all the people who work for us who are from the furthest away could escape for holidays a bit earlier. So we've got Adrian Craddock back home with his folks in Perth. We've got Hannah with her family in Canada. So yeah, it's you suddenly see all these people disappearing around the world.
That's why we're still here, isn't it? We haven't got far to go, unfortunately.
It's because we're blooming British. We're stuck here doing the weekly.
We're going to make it a great weekly. It's 181. I can't do any kind of dart commentary innuendo on that.
It's quite a nice number, though, 181.
181. It's all right, isn't it?
Yeah.
Let's make it a good show. Up next, the return of Tom Edwards with his always amusing crystal ball news gazing. And we welcome once again Monocle 24's news editor Tom Edwards to the studio. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Robert. Hi, Andrew. How are you both today?
We're very good. It's only 2 days to go, so don't get all tetchy. I can see you a little bit. You're meant to be in a good mood when Christmas approaches.
I'm in a fabulous mood. I love the festive period.
Andrew was telling me that you'd had a makeover. I failed to see this.
He's got new glasses.
Oh, yeah. Have you?
Yeah. No, I'm a dead ringer for Nana Mouskouri, apparently.
I did. I called up a picture of Nana Mouskouri, and
I thought it was a new mirror app that he was showing me.
And he's got a new jacket.
It's nice. I'm
trying to smarten up my act.
It's good.
As I'm always instructed to do. By the
you're very, you're very news.
I look news.
Yeah, very news. Oh. I like it.
Objective number one achieved.
Yeah. I had a feeling that, and Tom pretended this was true, that he had a twin brother, and they were managed to kind of lighten the workload by him sending his brother in every now and then.
Just the same.
Yeah, and it was only the glasses that gave it away. That was the only way that you could tell who was coming in on each day.
Yeah, Tom's good. He's like not a main character, not a star, but an extra in The Hour, the popular BBC TV series about the news.
Why not?
Right, here we go. Let's go. What's in the news?
Okay, let's start today. Let's start with a bit of aviation. You know, we like to do that here. Mm. Korean Airlines commencing direct flights to Sri Lanka. And this is quite interesting because this is all about trying to facilitate travel between Colombo and North America via Seoul.
Hang on, to say that route again.
From Colombo, between Colombo and North America via Seoul. That's the key strategic objective, I believe.
Yeah. So people stop off in Seoul and make it, and it gets hubba hubba.
Well, there are a lot of Sri Lankans heading to America these days.
Oh, yeah. It's a very, very big, very big international movement. Yeah. But in both directions. That's why. And so this is a kind of longer term strategy, global strategy to grow these key routes, new routes, continent expansion. Very exciting times.
Very exciting times. I wonder what sort of cuisine they'll be offering on there. I quite like the food on Korean Air. You get a bibimbap, which they do for you.
Come again?
You familiar with the sort of fried rice, vegetables, quite hot chili? They break an egg on top. That's a bibimbap, and it's served in a boiling hot stone basin, really. But on Korean Air,
try handing those out.
Yeah, but they do it. They do it very nicely in a sort of heavyweight plastic tureen on the plane. I wonder if they'll be serving a mixture of that and some of that Sri Lankan good stuff.
That's a pretty exciting combination, right?
I'm willing to go on that plane and test out the nib of that writing instrument. I'm willing to test that route out. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Get in touch, I guess.
I will. I'm just writing that down.
No, we don't take free trips.
Of course not.
I was joking,
of course, Andrew.
Okay.
What about Wednesday? Now, on Wednesday, this is very interesting from lovers of big new infrastructure projects. China is opening the world's longest high-speed railway. Now, that is genuinely...
Well, that is good.
Where's that going from until...
So this is between...
It's going from Sri Lanka...
to North America.
Via John King.
It's quite a bridge. No, this is between Beijing and Guangzhou, over 2,000 kilometres. And, of course, the opening on the 26th of December. What's the 26th?
Boxing Day.
It's the birthday of Mao Zedong.
In
memoriam, this big new project.
So they've saved it up for that day?
Absolutely.
Okay, nice.
Well, it was designed to hit the target and hit it. They have done. 300 kilometres per hour. That's an average speed. Just 8 hours to complete the journey. Pretty incredible.
People will be Googling that, won't they? Because a lot of people will know, probably in their mind's eye, where how far away those two cities are.
But if they can imagine this, they can alight along the way in other destinations. Wuhan, Zhengzhou, Changsha. Lots of different possibilities.
Okay.
I wouldn't mind an overnight in Wuhan. That sounds quite nice. Is that literally?
We're going to open a whole can of Wuhan.
Do you think Wuhan's like the Doncaster, like when you're going up to Scotland?
Yeah, or you're on the sleeper. Yeah, on the sleeper to Inverness.
We broke down in Wuhan.
All right. Thank you very much, Tom, for our sort of semi-seasonal news roundup. Coming up next, we're going to be speaking to Nick Barrett, who's written a book about the greater London suburbs.
Feliz Natal da Monocle 24.
God jul fra Monocle 24.
Joyeux Noël de la part de Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 より, Merry Christmas.
Både Karachan Kivan a Monocle Husanei.
Hei, det er Ole, så er vi Monocle 24.
For those of us, and there are many, who grew up with even a slight familiarity of the grey uniformity of Britain's suburbs, the outer reaches of our towns and cities are often overlooked in favour of a faster life of fun and frolics found in the inner city.
But as Monocle showed in its quality of life issue this summer, suburbia can still be a charming, innovative and, most of all, a healthy place to be. Our first guest, Nick Barrett, is a genealogist and historian focusing on the important role London's outskirts play in the evolution of the city. His recent book, Greater London, The Story of the Suburbs, tells us why keeping up with the Joneses can help you keep a whole city going. Nick, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Can we just start with a very basic thing, actually, about what the suburbs are? Because reading your book, I think, you know, there's, you know, what we traditionally think of the suburbs of, you know, nice houses on the edge of the, on the outskirts of the city, a kind of a bit of a utopia perhaps in the 20s and 30s. But you also look at, you know, actually what seems to me kind of to border on the inner city as well. You're in Notting Hill and you're looking at the kind of high density housing and, you know, the rise of the tower block. What for you constitutes a suburb?
Well, for me, and taking a very literal view, it's anything outside or below the walls of London itself. And that really helped to try and define the geographical boundaries of the book in many ways. So looking at London as an early Roman settlement, pretty much that was it. And as you develop into the 19th century, that's when you start to get this, I don't know, suburban creep into some of the grassier fields outside. Yeah, we very much assume that today the suburbs are those outer boroughs with those wonderful semi-detached houses and people mowing their lawns on a Sunday. But for most of the time, suburban London was what you would now consider the inner part of the city in its own right. So strictly speaking, London is the square mile. Even Westminster in its own right was a suburb.
So I think you look at the, like, the Georgian buildings, they kind of get pulled when they were on the edge of the city. They were the old suburbs. Has there always been a slight sniffiness? Because what's funny about the suburbs, and to say somebody is a bit suburban or that they, you know, anything is a bit suburban, is a bit of a damning term. Has it always been ever thus? Were the kind of, were the Romans a bit snooty about the people who lived just beyond the city wall? And has that just, what is it about the suburbs that kind of gets some people's backs up?
I think it's that Middle England attitude, and those who live in the centre feel like they're the real Londoners. A lot of this goes down to identity and how and why people move to those outer suburbs in the first place. There's always been a bit of a sense that if you're suburban, you're not rich enough to live far enough out to commute in via coach and horses in the Georgian period and have your nice villa on Hampstead Heath overlooking the city in its own right. You're kind of making do. You're having your Georgian townhouse, which is a compressed version of what people would normally aspire to live in a bit further out. And that, I think, has been the way from the 18th century onwards. So suburban living is seen as a compromise in many ways. It's an aspiring class of people that have got just far enough up the social scale to escape from their working class roots, but not high enough to mix with the gentry, the great and the good, those who've actually colonised some of these areas themselves.
Nick, I wanted to ask you if you felt there was a kind of golden age of the London suburb. I kind of think of three things when I think of suburbs. I think of the kind of John Betjeman cosiness of the suburbs and the metropolitan, riding the metropolitan line. I think of the spookiness of J.G. Ballard's suburbs and the sort of psychopathy that's inherent in the neatness of the suburbs. And then I kind of think of Jerry and June or The Good Life, you know, and this kind of sitcom version of the suburbs. Which one seems like the real thing, or are they all these three versions dotted around London?
Well, I don't think I'm going to win the argument that the inner parts of London are seen as suburban today. So if we stick to that outer belt, in many ways it was the 20s and 30s, this deliberate policy to create groups of settlements that were connected to the centre via the Metropolitan Railway line, for example. And they are the heyday of the suburbs for me. You've got some quite interesting architecture. For the first time, there is a deliberate housing policy to provide property that's affordable, that has all the luxuries and mod cons to help those who've just come back from the Great War. So there's almost a philanthropic element to things that we see, some of the great garden suburb projects such as Hampstead and further out Welling Garden City. So there's this real idealistic view of what people can and should aspire to. Let's make this housing affordable. Let's make it comfortable as well. And I think it's that got up people's noses too. But certainly by the time you get to the 70s, the suburban dream has become very tired, very hackneyed. It is seen as a snobbish attitude. I mean, The Good Life was filmed in Surbiton, in Kingston. Yet actually, the setting was in North London. And yeah, you can, in many ways, juxtapose South London with North London. And you will see the same almost quite tired rows of houses, as you said, this sort of what lies behind those net curtains, everyone's sneaking a peek on everyone else's lives. I think that does the suburbs down quite a lot. There is a lot of diversity when you actually start looking at the individual places. So whilst you might see another row of terraced houses, the actual character that lies behind them is very different. And that's what I like to investigate in the book. The social factors, the different forces that create that sense of excitement, that it's not the same in different parts of London. You really have that unique identity and character.
And historically, the kind of the big booms in the last two or three centuries for the suburbs, they all seem to be transport linked. I guess the railways go in, so suddenly you can come into the centre of London by train quite quickly. So areas that were former farmland suddenly seem quite convenient for the city. Then it's the underground, and then it's the modern car in the 20s and 30s. Now as our transport gets clogged up and things, do you feel that that's the end of the heyday in a way for the suburbs? Because, you know, You can't really drive in if you live in Wembley these days. You know, you can't think about commuting off on a bus because it's so slow. Do you think that the transport thing is still connected with the success or the failure of our suburbs?
I think that you cannot take the suburbs without looking at the history of the railway. Road, yeah, okay, that's a fairly modern phenomenon, and quite a lot of the 20s and 30s houses have their little purpose-built garages. That's all fine and well and good. But as you said, transport on the roads is a nightmare. Anyone who's lived in London wouldn't tell you that immediately. And so you can still get that commuter suburban belt. Perhaps it's even further out than we perhaps think now. You know, people coming in from Reading to the centre of London, or perhaps those outer suburbs where now you've got places of work. So, yes, the history of the creation of the suburbs is very much about transportation, but I'd argue that it still continues today. And if anything, you're seeing London suburbs stretching even further out. An hour from London could take you into Grantham, for example, or Reading, or even, dare you say, across the Channel. So you can get to the heart of London, you can be a suburban commuter far more easily thanks to higher speed rail communications. Forget the car. That's in many ways an outmoded way of looking at suburban life. Many people have gone back to the bicycle as a way of getting around their suburbs and then getting into the centre as well, particularly with all the green space that was deliberately put in around it. So as we start to see increasing debate about the use of greenbelt land and how people get in, you still have to look at that transport policy. And that's always going to be linked to the railways to get people into the heart of London, or indeed into those outer suburbs where you do find the business parks and the office complexes.
And is there such a thing as a suburban mindset, Nick? And we talked about perhaps we can mention Margot Ledbetter or something from The Good Life, and we kind of think that that might be a kind of suburban mindset. It's a bit of a keeping up with the Joneses thing and making your motors clean on a Sunday morning, right?
I think so. I mean, it is that aspirational trapment almost of being caught up in the suburban life and having to do what everyone else does. So Hyacinth Bouquet, another perfect example, wanted to climb the social ladder but still stuck in that suburban setting with her working class roots clinging to her in many ways. It's very strange. Again, it is about identity, and I don't think it is fair to generalise. It is, you know, the sort of sitcom that we see on TV, but actually when you get into some of the suburbs, not necessarily just on the outskirts, but into some of those communities that formed up in the end of the 19th century, you've got a huge amount of diversity, a really great mix of people. We've seen in the census records released for 2011 that Greater London as an area is the most ethnically diverse in this country. In fact, in many ways, you know, the white Anglo-Saxon population makes up 44% of London's ethnic mix. I mean, that in its own right tells you a lot about how the suburbs have been, in many ways, a melting pot for people coming into London. And that is reflected in the demographics of different parts of London. So in that sense, no, I don't think you can still apply those 70s stereotypes to what people think of or imagine themselves to be if they are now suburban. It's quite often accident that brings them there. And you get all that diversity in some of the high street shops and particularly the food outlets. You can tell an awful lot about the character of a suburb by walking up and down the high street and seeing the wide range of restaurants that tell you more about the people.
And I wanted to ask you about the architecture of some of them, whether you had sort of some greatest hits of the London suburbs. Because it was, as you say, it was a place shaped often by the motor car and stuff. It was the only place that deco and modernism kind of were ever taken on with much kind of esteem.
Along with Neo Tudor, though.
Exactly, with Mott Tudor. And what are, when you were researching the book, I guess you made a list of some of your favourite buildings.
Well, it was quite interesting because I actually started very close to home. And
so where's home? You should tell us. Well, where this book comes from.
Where this book comes from. Well, I mean, today, much to my publisher's dismay, I live outside of Greater London in Newell West. They were a little bit upset about that when I told them. But I used to live in Surbiton, and before that, in Hampton. Now, Surbiton's got the fantastic Art Deco station. Yeah. And it's been used in Poirot. But it's got a wide range of different architectural styles, some 1900 houses, some smaller terraces, of course, some of the large avenues that you find. For me, that sums up the suburbs. I don't have one particular style of architecture that I think imposes itself upon one suburb or another. It is the fact that you've got this eclectic mix, the heart of the historic village and the high streets of some of the older buildings there, not necessarily always going to be mock Tudor. Some of them are actually original, hidden away behind the Georgian facades. And at the end of the book, I look at Hampton, where I grew up, as a perfect example of how you can peel back the layers of this onion, if you like, and see that it grew out of a very tiny village. And then in the 20s, it sprawls out into these sort of, you know, suburban streets with the garages. That is the same everywhere you go around London. And for me, that sums it up. It's perfect. You see the
sprawling
old high street
and kind of car-centric.
Yeah. With the railway coming right the way through the middle, changing the names. When I grew up there, I walked down Station Road thinking, oh, I wonder why it's called Station Road. Because there's a station in it. But actually, when you look at the earlier maps, it was called New Street. Uh-huh. And that had been there for many hundreds of years. But that had only been put in as an extra route to get to Bushey Park and Hampton Court Palace, linked to the river, the waterworks come. You know, everything you start to take for granted in your suburb, where you live, if you start to just wind back the clock, look at some of the fantastic maps that are very easily available, you start to see your suburb, your street in a very different light. It gets that hidden character that perhaps has been airbrushed out. So yes, you can look at the different phases and styles, but the fact that they all mingle together in our suburbs makes it so interesting.
Perhaps, as a conclusion almost, you know, there's a political debate here as well. You know, that during the last elections for the mayor of London, there was this idea of the donut city, where you have this ring of kind of not very well off people in certain parts of the suburbs, and the core of the city certainly changed. You know, these days, if you're a new migrant to London, you won't go to Whitechapel because you'll find it's all bijou flats and you can't afford anything. So in fact, people, new migrants, do go to the fringes now. And I know in this office where we have like kind of Japanese people, they, you know, there's the territory that they go to because they know that all the kind of Japanese stores are there. And it's not in the city centre, it's, you know, out on the fringes.
And Croydon is like Little Korea, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which is amazing.
And pockets in Kingston. Yeah. And you've got areas where, particularly near the airport, you've had large populations from South Asia coming in. But that's the great thing about it. It flips back on itself. And now, for the first time, we're starting to see people come back into the inner areas, which traditionally were quite poor. And that's where you'd end up first of all. So it's really fluid. Hopefully there'll be a chance to rewrite large sections of the book in 20 years' time.
Revised edition.
Exactly, yes.
Well, nice. Well, Nick Barrett, author of Greater London, The Story of the Suburbs. Thank you very much for coming in to see us.
Thank you.
Backing a little further into the thematic cul-de-sac. Thank you, Tom. Let's hear a song now. This is Arcade Fire with The Suburbs. That was Arcade Fire with The Suburbs, and you're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. We'll be talking fair trade fashion next.
Stephen Newland is a seaplane pilot on Queensland's magnificent coastline and is in no doubt that the colourful, dazzling, awe-inspiring Great Barrier Reef is the finest natural wonder in the world.
I'd have to say, especially around this area here, the water and the scenery is just incredible. The Great Barrier Reef just changes every day. It's never the same.
There's nothing like Australia.
Whether you're looking for gift ideas, clothing, or something for the home, we can help. Monocle has a selection of beautifully appointed shops in New York, London, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and our latest edition in College Street, Toronto. Scarves by Drake, wallets by Ettinger, and wine cups by Hakkisan are just a small selection of Monocle's collaborations with designers from around the world. Plus, if you've got any gaps in your collection of Monocle back issues, well, we can help with that too. So do pop in and say hello at any of our Monocle shops.
In fashion circles, the term fair trade is becoming pretty fashionable itself. But the fair trade movement to establish sustainable, rewarding working environments in the poorer countries that produce much of the garments we wear has a longer history. One of the pioneers of fair trade fashion is Peopletree, the award-winning clothing company co-founded in 2001 by entrepreneurs Safia and James Minney. Earlier, I sat down with Safia and brand spokesman Dean Newcomb to find out how this most changeable, some might say fickle, of industries is learning to become more ethical. Safia and Dean, thank you very much for coming in to see us today. Safia, we spoke a few weeks ago following the fire in Bangladesh that saw some 120 workers killed in a factory there. Now, what's interesting, what you're doing is you're trying to produce products there in an ethical way. What was your reaction to that fire? Because it must be complicated for other people who, even if they're buying ethical fashion, they turn over a product or they look inside a label and they see that word Bangladesh. What kind of concerns did it raise for you in the way you run your business and for the factories and the people that you know in the country?
Well, Andrew, we've been working with the National Garment Workers Federation, which is the largest trade union in Bangladesh, for about 18 years. So we go into the slums and we often hear directly from the garment workers that produce for the brands in the British High Street exactly what the issues are in terms of incredibly low pay that's very delayed, that they're unable to eat as much as 2,000 calories in a day. So we know the problems that fast fashion, the pressures that fast fashion are putting workers under. And the way that we've structured the Peopletree fair trade business is such that we can pay people more than 30% than garment workers in factories would earn in their rural environment. So their cost of living would be a third of what it would be in urban areas. So for us, it was a shock. For me personally, it was an enormous shock because 6-7 years ago, there started to be fire exits attached to factories. They looked like they were made of aluminium foil. So you really wondered whether, you know, if 60 people started running down them at the same time, whether they would just peel off the buildings. But they, you know, health and safety started to be being discussed about 8 years ago. So it is a shock. It's a shock that that you know, health and safety, clearly there isn't adequate legislation in place in Bangladesh, that multinational brands, you know, despite having a lot of blah, blah, blah on their websites, actually are not doing the proper checks. And I think the third thing is that consumers, you know, need to care more. They need to put more pressure on brands to change their practice.
Now, we're talking here about a slightly sophisticated audience in a sense, because, you know, you're asking people when they look at the label and they see Peopletree and the word Bangladesh to have very positive associations with those two things. Now, when they go to the high street and they see that name, we're trying to encourage them to think, actually, if that T-shirt's costing £2 or £3, there's a reason for that. Somebody's not getting their money along the chain. Do you find that, you know, even with your audience, the kind of people who are looking for ethical fashion, do you find that quite a complicated concept to get over sometimes?
We haven't, partly because fair trade and the model of trading is relatively well established, especially here in the UK and in Japan where Peopletree started. I think people understand that it's not just about fair wages, it's also about advance payments, it's about the health and safety conditions and giving the ownership back to the producers themselves. So people do understand fair trade relatively well. I think there has been a stigma attached to fair trade where, you know, 20 years ago, a fair trade garment, you know, was some hippie, hempy, you know, awful thing that, you know, you wouldn't wear except for to a festival. So overcoming, you know, that stigma, I think, was probably the biggest issue.
Now, before I bring Dean in, I'm throwing words in here that you probably making you cringe. Is ethical the wrong word? Is, you know, fair trade the right word? I think for the public, again, there's probably a little bit of confusion about what all those terms mean. You seem to use the term fair trade more than anything else. What's the key word for you in all of this?
Well, ethical fashion is a much broader term that's used for fair trade, organic, upcycling, recycling. You know, if you go to a second-hand shop and you buy from a second-hand shop, that could also be categorised as ethical fashion. So fair trade is a way of trading with producers directly, a product that's new. It incorporates both social and environmental criteria in every stage of the production and the trading process.
Well, we have more than brains around. We have brains and good looks at the other end of the table. Before I go,
thanks, Andrew.
Well, we have lots of good looks and brains around the table. But we have a fully fledged model here from Japan. Well, you're not Japanese, of course. You're from England, from Nottingham. You were telling me, Dean.
That's right, Andrew.
Now, you've become involved in PeopleTree over 4 years. First of all, I presume by getting a phone call and saying, "Will you turn up a model?" But you seem to have invested quite a lot of yourself into what's going on with PeopleTree. And in fact, you're going to be going to Bangladesh, aren't you, to follow the story of a shirt being made?
That's right. For me, it was actually wonderful to find PeopleTree because I wanted to live my life in a more sustainable way. And I wasn't aware until learning about fair trade that there was so much we could do just by the things that we purchase. So since for the last 2 years, I've been working with PeopleTree. That's been a wonderful collaboration for me. It's very rare as a model that we get to kind of choose clients that we enjoy to model for, that we believe in the brand.
And it's also very rare to be asked to think about what you're putting on, I guess.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, what is it about the PeopleTree model that particularly appeals? And it's interesting for both of you, you're both outsiders who, you know, Safia, who's set up this business in Japan, you're a model who's now helping this business in Japan. Is it interesting in a way that it's rooted in Japan? Do you think there's something quite Japanese at the heart of what's going on with this company?
I think the model can work anywhere. It's been interesting for me. Obviously, my position maybe is to try to influence people in my community. It's very easy, let's say, to influence the Japanese female community. They seem to pick up on fair trade a lot more, and they seem to have this more of a connection with the things that they wear. They seem to have like a more personal connection to fair trade.
Now let's just go into a little bit of the history of PeopleTree, Safia, so that people around the world who are listening today can understand what you're trying to do. First of all, how come you did start it in Japan?
Well, I arrived in Japan when I was 25.
5 years ago.
Absolutely, yeah. About 21 years ago, 23 years ago. What was really exciting was working for the first body shop in Japan and finding that a huge number of Japanese women were coming in and really excited about the politics behind body shop. You know, they weren't just excited about, you know, this British European brand that smelt of a certain way. I'd been working in social marketing for about 4 years before that in London. And, you know, what was great about this new home was that I was finding people who had similar values and really wanted to be part of the change. So I set up Global Village that then turned into PeopleTree. So first, you know, looking at information on recycling and where you could eat organic and how you could spend your money and your time in a way that would lead to social change. So PeopleTree now has about 350 stockists in Japan, in Hong Kong, in Taiwan. We started PeopleTree 10 years ago in the UK, and now we sell throughout Germany and Holland and Scandinavia, as well as the UK. And we have about 1,000 stockists. So bit by bit, we're creating a network with about 4,000 organic cotton farmers and artisans. And, you know, we're really passionate about handcrafted skill. So really adding value, because we believe that the only thing that really there is in plentiful supply in terms of resource in the world are people's hands.
Now, I was recently in Tokyo, lucky enough, with Monocle, and I went into a store and I saw People Tree chocolate as well. So you've gone beyond cotton. So what's the range of things that you could now find if you... And you should tell people the website as well, where they can find your products.
Yeah, well, in Japan, it's www.peopletree.co.jp and then peopletree.co.uk. It's a lifestyle brand in Japan, so we run right through from fair trade and organic fashion through handicrafts and interiors, and we have a big organic food company. We're actually the biggest fair trade and organic chocolate bar in Japan, which is really exciting. Here in the UK, we're more of a fashion brand, partly because, you know, it's very, very complicated working with more than 150 subgroups and fair trade groups around the developing world. We're mostly in Asia and Africa, and then a little bit in Latin America.
Dean, can I ask you, both as a consumer and as a supporter of People Tree, you know, Safia is in a very good position. She's kind of persuaded lots of people to follow her brand. But outside in the consumer market, I think there still is, you know, some kind of residual kind of fear that, you know, kind of buying ethical or buying green fashion or fair trade fashion, there will be this kind of hemp association that Safia was referencing earlier, that if you do something that's good, it can't actually be beautiful as well. Now, you're modelling the products. What do you think of the actual product that you're getting to wear? And what do you think about the, you know, they're not compromises, but the decisions that have to be made to produce those garments?
Right. I'm actually top to toe in People Tree stuff right now.
Okay. And you're not in any hemp. Let me make that clear.
And it's not hemp. And it's probably moved on a long way. And I'm not sure just saying fair trade has maybe got a stigma attached to it. But I mean, for me, it's the quality and the feel. Obviously, having a personal connection with clothing is something that you can only really do with fair trade. To know that somebody out there made that, you know, with a smile on the face, that's a wonderful feeling. But also, yeah, these clothes do feel fantastic. They're 100% organic cotton, and you can actually feel the difference in that. The shapes, the fits. I love the brand. I love the style.
It's brilliant. Yeah. An interesting thing we've often discussed here at Monocle is, you know, that it's fascinating how when it comes to, say, you know, where your eggs come from, when people go to the supermarket, there's, you know, a kind of reluctance amongst a kind of middle class shopper to take anything that doesn't say organic. But when they want to know how that chicken was reared, and they're concerned about the chicken's life. But oddly, when they go to purchase their clothing, they'll walk out of the, you know, the organic farmer's market, and they'll cross the road and they'll go to a fast fashion retailer, and they'll spend £5 on a t-shirt. And there's less of a concern about knowing the story of the person behind that product. Is that something you're aware of, do you think, in the world of fashion?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the huge brands that are producing things in third world countries have done a really good job of keeping those people's lives hidden from the public. Without our knowledge of actually what's going on in those third world countries, it's hard to care, right?
Yeah, and Safia, do you think the same? Do you think I've often wondered whether you should have webcams in the factories which are making your products. And so, you know, that just as we have an open kitchen when you go to many restaurants these days, they want you to see the workers and they want you to see the process. It would be amazing if you could actually kind of log onto your favourite brands and see the factory floor where your training shoes are coming from or where your T-shirts are coming from.
I think it's a nice idea. I think you wouldn't really tell the whole story with a webcam. I think the issue is that there isn't really much enforcement of legislation in the developing countries where our clothes are made, and that really has to be stepped up. But the power of fashion brands now, you know, it's the sixth largest industry in Britain, is such that even with very, very high level journalists and celebrities and opinion leaders running stories and documentaries, often these are spiked at the last possible moment because, you know, the legal costs in airing something is something that the media owner is not prepared to foot. So the real story isn't getting out there. And, you know, we've started something called Fair Trade Study Tours, which is bringing fashion buyers from both Japan and the UK out to meet the producers to learn more about the true costs of conventional fashion. So going into the slums, talking with garment workers, but then also going into a fair trade project to see what the difference is in terms of, you know, the working environment, the development that can be done on the back of receiving a fair trade premium in terms of building schools and and health and literacy programs. So I think it's, you know, it's really, you know, opening up, being truly transparent and accountable that will bring this thing to play. But it's you know, it's a very difficult thing.
Now, finally, before we conclude, I think I've made everyone a little bit miserable with the last couple of questions. So let's end on a more positive and up note. What do you think are the positive signs over the coming years for both PeopleTree and the work that you're trying to do, Safia?
Well, we've started doing trade shows, fashion trade shows in both Japan and around Europe. And we found that the business has grown by about 30% in the last year and a half, which in a recessionary environment is really exciting. So I think, you know, in Japan and the UK, in Japan and Germany, where people are thinking of a low carbon, really green, sustainable alternative, you know, they're turning to brands that sit with their values. And that's where PeopleTree's becoming much more popular.
That was Sophia Minnie and Dean Newcomb of the PeopleTree speaking to Andrew earlier. Up next, we'll be talking to musician Kuljit Bamra about Christmas music, Bangra style.
Tully Kadar, a barista at Mecca Espresso in stunning Sydney, can't decide between the incredible warmth of the people and the outstanding beauty of the scenery when it comes to what makes life in Australia such a daily delight.
We have beautiful weather, a lovely culture, a unique sense of humour. Quality of life is just very high, and I'm very proud of the Aussie culture. I like our matter-of-factness. I feel like we have sort of a good balance between the outgoing, almost ostentatious American style and the very reserved British sensibility. I feel like we kind of land a healthy balance, and the culture's pretty cool.
There's nothing like Australia.
It's time for a Christmas classic now, but one with something of a twist. You're listening to the music of Kuljit Bamra, the British Bangra musician, whose latest album, A Jolly Bolly Christmas, takes seasonal favourites and adds a little Asian spice to the mix.
Bangra is the popularised form of Indian and Pakistani music from the Punjabi region that's been honed in the UK from the 1960s onwards. And Kuljit is one of its most celebrated practitioners, with a career spanning film school work for the Indiana Jones franchise and Bend It Like Beckham, to being an in-demand studio producer and tabla player for over 20 years. And he joins us now to explain a little more about the Asian music scene and why he feels Christmas culture is in need of a freshen up. Kuljit, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you very much.
Now let's deal with A Jolly Bolly Christmas first. We just heard that clip. It sounded like intoxicating stuff. I feel like I'm looking forward to seeing my relations sway over the turkey this year,
rather than just
nibble at it. How did the Christmas kind of collaboration and Bangra collaboration start?
Well, I think I'm known as a serial collaborator anyway to start off with. So that's the sort of fundamental issue in my life. And then I've always had an idea of doing a Christmas, sort of Indian Christmas take on carols and stuff like that. But it's strange because I was brought up in a Sikh family. But when we moved to Southall in 1969, I went to Sunday school. So it was really strange. So sort of seeing men with long white beards was a bit confusing because I didn't know whether they were Moses or Guru Nanak. So anyway, I thought for the last 5 years, I always thought I wanted to do a Christmas CD and sort of encompass the whole cultural sort of feeling of what Christmas is for British Asians, you know. So, yeah, and I did it this year, so at last managed to find the time to do it.
Nice.
And of course, just for people around the world who perhaps don't know as much about Bangra as perhaps it's become a kind of a musical force.
Do,
but it's become a musical force in the UK. It's something you would have seen in the charts, you see on TV.
Yeah.
But could you just explain to us its background? Because you talk about your desire to collaborate. In a way, the music itself is a collaboration between various cultures and different influences.
Sure. I mean, I think it's strange because I've got a love-hate relationship with collaboration and fusion, because really music should just be music. But, you know, because we're human beings, we've got a tendency to want to put them into boxes and stuff. But Bangra really is And in fact, we've only had one Bangra song in the charts, which was the Punjabi MC track, and even that was, with all respect, sort of gimmicky rather than... I don't think the time's come yet when we can handle Bangra in the charts.
Yeah.
But for those of you that don't know, Bangra is... it started off as a folk music from the Punjab, and Punjab is made up of two words, Punjab. So Punj meaning five, ik, do, tin, char, Punj. So Punjab is a land of five rivers, and so therefore the soil's very fertile. And the people that come from the Punjab are either farmers, the landowners, or they're technicians that work on the farm. So my family originally from the Punjab were technicians, so we're very good with wood and metal and stuff like that. But basically Punjabis are sort of, I suppose if you were to stereotype a farming culture, Punjabis like to have a, you know, to make merry and have a bit of a drink. And then during the harvest season, we go out and dance in the field. So Bangra was originally... was
and you made your own electric guitar, obviously.
Exactly, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Not just Brian May.
No, exactly, yeah. So I mean, Bangra started off as a dance form, really. And then people like myself and another producer, Deepak Kazanji, we really popularised Bangra as a music style. And so I always say that Bangra is a British invention alongside fish and chips and chicken tikka masala.
Which are neither of them being specifically English things, but fusion things, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's British. They're British things, aren't they? So, yeah.
And is it, we heard from that that slice of that track that we before you came on, we heard that kind of like really driving rhythmic percussion to it. Is that kind of like one of the signature parts of the genre?
Yeah, I mean, Bangra's very, very rhythmical. It's drum-based and, you know, because... electricity is sort of sparse in India and it's not always reliable. So a lot of the instruments in India are acoustic instruments.
Yeah.
And the Punjabi dhol is a big, D-H-O-L, is a big sort of barrel drum. And that's typically played in Bangra music. And it's got that sort of chinky, 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 ching sort of swing to it, you know. And that's how you recognise a Bangra rhythm.
And the tabla as well, I presume. Mm. I mean, you're a tabla player, that's part of the thing. It's a kind of... This presumably is part of it as well, but it's not that deep welly kind of bass.
Yeah, no, tabla's not deep welly. It's more sort of it's a lighter welly, you know.
Yeah, but, I think it's more of a cut-off hunter.
Yeah,
right.
You can
not
say that.
Full on.
Not full on. Yeah, yeah. Sort of, yeah, three-quarter length. I would say. I mean, tabla's more of a classical instrument, although it is the most popular percussion instrument in India. But actually, people that know tabla as a two-piece drum. Some of you might know that the tabla started off as a log drum, and then at some point, history says it got cut in half, and, you know, for battle purposes, it was hung over each side of the beast in battle, and that's how it became a two-piece drum. But tabla's normally courtesan sort of instrument, and it's more... it's not fair to say it's got more finesse with it, but it's more of a classical recital-type instrument. But I love tabla, and I like grooving with tabla rather than doing... 1,000 notes a minute, you know. So.
And is it, I mean, it's Bangra genre that has, do you see it kind of, I mean, like everything does, like every sort of thing does, and we said we didn't want to necessarily squeeze each other into pigeonholes, but do you see it as a genre kind of unfolding and kind of getting more complex or picking up the associations of each country that it touches?
I think it does pick up the associations of each country, and even in this country, I mean, I think I would say Bangra peaked in sort of 1990, It's always have like Bangra house and you have acid Bangra, R&B. So it always follows a sort of Western trend. But
Andrew's writing these down for Christmas.
The Christmas quiz, yeah. And then I think it's just, I think the thing that really frustrates me is that it's still not in the charts. That's, you know, that we still, Indian music still is predominantly sort of trying to appeal to the Western masses. You know, I think that's a problem, really, for me. Yeah. But I, in a way, because I have this whole... I work in the world of... in the corridor of East meets West, and it's always frustrating because I thought East met West ages ago. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
we keep meeting all the time. So, but I think it's a celebration of that sort of corridor.
But does it frustrate you even more, though? Because, oddly, that you know, what's termed in that broad category of Indian music is adopted for TV commercials and for all sorts of... you know, riffs and other kind of bands, music.
Mm.
Do you find it annoying that it be taken in, sliced up and used in those commercial ways, but actually for people to sit down and, as you say, buy the records and appreciate it in a broader sense is a bit slower coming?
Yeah, I think that's slightly annoying. But having said that, you know, it's good that it's sliced up and taken in small bite-sized chunks for people. And, you know, Bangra's, I mean, you know, I did some work on Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the movie with Johnny Depp. And if you now re-listen to the Oompa Loompa song,
yeah,
you'll realise it's a Bangra rhythm.
Yeah, I remember
so
that.
So it's sort of there in the culture, but it hasn't been, you know, people don't go, oh, that's jazz, oh, that's pop, oh, that's Bangra. And I think it's just a matter of people relating to it in that way. I mean, what is also slightly frustrating is that the sort of pop format of music has got a particular structure to it. It's got to be 3.5 minutes long, you know, verse, chorus structure. I don't think we're ready yet to take anything different than that. And that's the bit that's slightly frustrating, but that's what drives my boat, you know, and that's what keeps me going, I suppose.
And I mean, I wonder whether the last kind of, I don't know whether the last crossover genre, but, you know, we have dance music, techno music and stuff, which has influenced a lot of pop music, chart pop music this year, it seems. There's a kind of real kind of weird return to a sort of bare bones electro and kind of quite kind of happy house music and stuff. Can Bangra be a genre like hip hop, where it's kind of, it's very proud of kind of what it comes from, where it comes from and what it has to say? Or can it simply just be nice commercial stuff that
I think it could be both of those, you know. Yeah. I think as I say, it hasn't got to that stage where people go, oh, I'll have a glass of red wine and put on some Bangra. You know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, we
time to run yourself
yet.
A nice hot bath. It's yeah. The best of Bangra.
Yeah. Slapping around in the bath. Like a seal, a Bangra seal. Yeah.
Going back to the Jolly Bolly Christmas record.
Sure.
Some of these, God Rest You Merry Gentlemen. Mm. And Silent Night. Well, Silent Night, for example, everyone will know that, wherever they're listening in the world. That seems like a tricky thing to reconstitute as a Bangra track.
They're not all Bangra tracks because, I mean, I called it Jolly Bolly because Bolly's really obviously Bollywood. Yeah. Now, but Bollywood really, most people think of Bollywood as lots of dancing people, very colourful. What's interesting in the last sort of 10 years is that Bollywood has actually become quite Bangraized in a way as a result of the work that we've been doing in the UK. So I've given it a Bolly title, even though there is Bangra in there and Bolly as well. Some of the tracks, like you mentioned, I mean, if you listen to Ding Dong Marillion High,
yeah.
I mean, a lot of my friends say it just gives them goosebumps. And it's not done in a Bangra rhythmical style, but it's done in a very, what I would think people would imagine Indian spiritual music to be, more chill out and more drone-based. And if you listen to that, that's a beautiful track in its own right, really, even if you haven't heard the original one. It's up for people to decide, really. I mean, it's also fine by me if they hate it. And it's also fine by me if they love it. You know what I mean? I mean, it's difficult to please everybody, isn't it?
Well, we like what we heard. We'll have to play it. We'll have to stick some of this on the Monocle playlist over Christmas because it sounds too good for everyone to miss. The record is A Jolly Bolly Christmas. Cool Jit Rama, thank you so much for joining us on The Weekly. It's that time of year when the world falls in love. And we have to say goodbye, Andrew, don't we?
It's that
time of the show where we have to say goodbye and say Merry Christmas.
Maybe with a Bangra backing we needed.
Yeah?
I'm going to take this A Jolly Bolly Christmas. I want to listen to all of this.
Yeah, I'm going to have that. I think that's going to be a good one around the dining room table come Christmas Day.
I like the cover. It kind of has a Sikh gentleman with like nice curly slippers and his drum looking very happy and his lady wife, I presume, getting on down.
It might not be his wife.
You might have just met her only recently.
Look on his face. That's not his wife, is it? He's just met her. God, that's an awful. What an awful thing to say. I tell you what, though, I wouldn't mind a pair of his slippers. With the Turkish slipper, aren't they?
Yeah, with a nice curly toe.
Man, I love that.
Classics, songs, comedy. It promises, and it delivers.
We should say then our goodbyes for this edition 181 of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Pilar Lopez, and our studio manager was Jack Phillips. We'll be throwing the keys to Santa's sled to Monocle's New York team of Aisha Spears and Barrett Austin next week. But Andrew and I will be back in a fortnight to mull over the best of the last year here on the Monocle Weekly. Until then, it's goodbye from me, Robert Bound.
And from me, Andrew Tuck. Have a happy Christmas.